So the title for my presentation today is The Ways We Think, and it's the same title that I used in the book that I recently published with Wiley Blackwell. So what I'm attempting to do in the book, which is obviously the wider project, is to take a critical look at some of the predominant ways in which the development of thinking is being understood in educational theory, practice and policy. So some examples of the educational context that I'm talking about is things like the field of critical thinking, which is probably the most familiar way in which the development of thinking gets talked about in education, and that sort of holds across school education and higher education. Also, discourses about thinking skills, which have grown up in the UK from the national curriculum in the noughties, and also some factions of the philosophy for children / philosophy in schools movement, which is gaining some traction in the UK and elsewhere in recent years. So my claim is that these approaches operate with a problematic and limited understanding both of thinking and of the human being who thinks. And I'm aiming in my book to develop an alternative account. The presentation today is going to be focused on one strand of this argument, where I attempt to deal with a prominent thinker of critical thinking in education called Harvey Siegel. And I initially published some thoughts on this in a journal article in the Journal of Philosophy of Education. And Harvey Siegel very recently has written a response to my critique of his position, which is not published yet, but I'm sure it will be soon. So I'm currently kind of in the process of trying to work out a response to his reply. So I'm really grateful to have the opportunity to talk to you about this topic in this environment. There's three parts of the presentation today. Firstly, I'm going to say a bit about Siegel's position, which I hope is interesting. Secondly, I'll propose an outline of the phenomenological alternative that I'm seeking to develop. And then in the final part, I want to give an example from my own teaching practice to sort of illustrate the kind of thing I'm proposing. So I'm talking now about Siegel's conception. It's emblematic, really, of a wider discourse about thinking, as I said, in education, but just to give some specificity, I'm going to look specifically at Siegel. His position is characterised as the reasons conception of critical thinking. And if we look at the first quotation on your handouts, this is kind of emblematic of the sort of thing he'd characterise. So Siegel says, to be a critical thinker is to be appropriately moved by reasons. To be a rational person is to believe and act on the basis of reasons. There is a deep conceptual connection by way of the notion of reasons, between critical thinking and rational persons. Critical thinking is best conceived, consequently, as the educational cognate of rationality. Critical thinking involves bringing to bear all matters relevant to the rationality of belief and action, and education aimed at the promulgation of critical thinking is nothing less than education aimed at fostering rationality and the development of rational persons. So a key feature of Siegel's account is a close link that he posits between reasoning and epistemology. And he explains the nature of this connection in the second quotation. He says, critical thinking requires that the student be able to assess reasons and their warranting force properly, and that this in turn requires that students have a good grasp of the principles governing such assessment. A full account of the reason assessment component involves more than this, however. In addition to the ability to assess reasons and their warranting force and a grasp of the related governing principles, critical thinkers need to have a theoretical grasp of the nature of reasons, warrant, and justification. And so some understanding of why a given putative reason is to be assessed as it is. That is, the reason assessment component involves epistemology. It's worth mentioning that lots of practical guidebooks that are around in critical thinking and education certainly promote the kind of activities that Siegel would approve of. So we have things like the Critical Thinking Concise Guide, which says that it equips students with the concepts and techniques used in the identification, analysis, and assessment of arguments. And it claims it will provide students with the tools to become a successful critical thinker who can act and believe in accordance with good reasons and articulate and make explicit those reasons. Siegel's not primarily writing for a practitioner audience, though, because he's a philosopher of education. So for better or worse, he acknowledges that his conception of critical thinking is based on a certain philosophical tradition. Third quotation now. In Educating Reason, which is his main book, I offered four reasons for thinking critical thinking constitutes a fundamental educational ideal. Respect for students as persons, self-sufficiency and preparation for adulthood, initiation into the rational traditions and democratic living. In my view, the fundamental justification for regarding critical thinking as an educational ideal is the first moral one. This alleged justification is obviously enlightenment or modernist in its individualistic orientation, just as the conception of critical thinking, allegedly justified by it, is equally modernist in its valorization of rationality. So I want to claim that this modernist enlightenment paradigm that Siegel inherits, and which I think can be perceived also, as I said, in the wider discourse about thinking and education today, is philosophically contentious. Moreover, I want to suggest that it's leading to a limited conception of thought and of rationality and reasoning itself. To that end, I look at alternative conceptions of thinking in other traditions, and phenomenology is one of the traditions that I look at in my book, as I look at Heidegger. But I also am interested in wider traditions that show this sort of receptivity to a richer view of thought. So I look at ordinary language philosophers such as Ryle and Austin, and more recently, the work of Jacques Derrida. These thinkers, what kind of brings these thinkers together, in my view, is their sort of shared attempt to try and do justice to the everyday lived experience of our thinking in all its complexity and its variety. So I'm talking today just about the phenomenological type strand of this argument, because I'm looking at Heidegger as an alternative to Siegel. I called my original article on this topic In Excess of Epistemology, and by using that title I was trying to connote two things really. Firstly, the way in which there's a sort of excess in our thinking, in our ways of thinking, that comes to the fore through Heidegger's writings. I also talk about this in terms of the sort of openness of thought, and I'm going to say a bit more about that in a moment. Secondly, I was trying to suggest the way that the Heideggerian understanding of thinking itself exceeds the conceptions of thought that are part of the general territory of epistemology as it's formally practiced and understood. So I'm not saying that Heidegger is against epistemology, is against knowledge, but I'm looking at the way in which his account can be read as challenging some of the underpinning assumptions to the epistemological project of philosophy. So my point of departure for the discussion was Charles Taylor's essay, Overcoming Epistemology. And that's not because I think Taylor's essay is, you know, the best around. I like it, but I do think it's got certain limitations. So I take that approach instead because Siegel himself had engaged with Taylor's argument and had critiqued it. For Siegel, phenomenology, Taylor, Heidegger, these thinkers don't really challenge this view of thinking at all. He says they leave it pretty much as it is. I haven't got time to tell you the whole details of Siegel's account, but the basic points are Siegel reads the main kind of lever in the phenomenological challenge being that it shows us that before we can form representations of the world, we are engaged agents who are kind of coping with the world. So Siegel says that, as he puts it, phenomenology opens us to this idea of the background, the sense that there is the influence of language, history, culture, and conceptual scheme upon our thinking. Siegel's claim is that this doesn't really challenge his account because it only amounts to a claim about what our representations of the world are caused by. So for Siegel, acknowledgement of the influence of the background doesn't preclude us from getting down to the business of critical thinking and seeking to gain some critical perspective, critical leverage over the background and the fundamental presuppositions of thought that we inherit as a result. What I want to suggest is that Siegel's missed something here, that he's kind of missed the significance of the Heideggerian argument. So I'll now give you a sense of the position I'm moving towards here. Very, very condensed, so sorry about that. I want to take issue basically with two ways in which Siegel interprets Heidegger, which I've just mentioned. Firstly, the way that Siegel calls this a causal account of how our thinking happens, and secondly, Siegel's interpretation of the background as just being this idea that we're influenced by language, history, culture, conceptual scheme. I'd say that both of these constructs are problematic, because they make it sound as though what we're addressing here is an empirical claim. In other words, Siegel's reading makes it seem like Heidegger's suggesting that our thinking is, as a matter of contingent fact, influenced by things like language, history, and culture. But I think Heidegger's point is trying to cut deeper than this. It's not a point about empirical contingent causes, but about the conditions of possibility of thinking itself. I'd say this marks an interesting and important difference between the background that Siegel accepts in his account, and which is one that could in principle be brought to our critical reflection, and Heidegger's point, which for me suggests that the conditions of thought are things that we can never fully step outside, precisely because those conditions are structurally not the kinds of things that can be brought to thematization and conceptualization. So in my paper, I look at two Heideggerian tropes, if you like, to explain this idea more fully. Firstly, looking at the idea of the background, the kind of as structure to our thinking. And that's the sort of fourth quote I'm going to skip over. The second one is Heidegger's discussion of language, which for me really plays an important role here in his understanding of the conditions of thinking. Heidegger's idea that language speaks suggests to us that language is both revealing and disclosing of the world. What Heidegger draws our attention to here then is the sort of poetic element of language, its capacity for letting be. One example of this that Heidegger talks about is the process of naming things. He says, in naming things are called forth. They're not called forth, though, in the sense of becoming called to an object present at hand. It's not related to a kind of technical or abstract bringing forth of the thing. It's a non-technical process. And he says that language, right before it's a tool of communication and of representing the world in this sort of abstract way, it's itself a way of giving and supplying ways of thinking. So to summarise, the discussion of the background and language is really taking me towards the point that what Heidegger's opening us to is the sense that the conditions of our thought are that should be thought in a way that exceeds the kind of explicit justification and explanation that seems to go all the way down in Siegel's account. So I want to end then by saying something specific about the kind of picture of thinking that might follow from this. In his later writings, Heidegger talks about thinking in terms of a handicraft. These themes, I take it, are nicely drawn out by Stanley Cavell in an essay on Heidegger and Emerson. And this is the quotation, the sixth one. I've unfortunately cut out a few words, so let me read the whole quote from Cavell. Emerson writes, "I take this evanescence and lubricity of all objects, which lets them slip through our fingers when we clutch hardest, to be the most unhandsome part of our condition. You may either dismiss or savour the relation between the clutching fingers and the hand in handsome as a developed taste for linguistic oddity, or you might further relate it to Emerson's recurring interest in the hand, and thence to Heidegger's sudden remark, thinking is a handicraft, by which he means both that thinking makes something happen and that it makes something happen in a particular way, since the hand is a uniquely human possession. The hand is infinitely different from all grasping organs. Emerson's image of clutching and Heidegger's of grasping emblematise their interpretation of Western conceptualising as a kind of sublimated violence. The overcoming of this will require the achievement of a form of knowledge both Emerson and Heidegger call reception." The intuition here then is that the clutching and grasping that tends to characterise thinking in modern philosophy doesn't serve us well, given the slippery and intractable nature of things that are there for us to think about and which form the conditions for thinking itself. What we need to learn instead is a mode of comportment to the world which is at once more open and more receptive to what comes. What we're aiming for in our thinking is therefore nothing like the security of a valid argument or the perceived success that might come from an adherence to abstract principles of reason assessment. Rather, we're concerned here with the quality of our attentiveness, responsiveness, and judgment. And this means we're being attentive not only in how we think, but also about what calls for thinking. As Pascal put it, we need to know when it is right to doubt, to affirm, to submit. And doing this is about opening ourselves to being struck by the intractability of the things we think about. To some people like Siegel, no doubt this is going to sound a bit romanticised. He'd probably say that being struck by something is not a matter to be. But I want to suggest that such attentiveness and receptiveness is not romanticised. It's there in the everyday ways in which our thinking gets going. A nice example of this is given in the Wittgensteinian quotation, that I've given, I think. I'm finding the right word, but I'm going to skip that because I knew that I wouldn't have time. Moreover, it's also there in the sort of abstract thinking that Siegel himself wants to foreground in his account of critical thinking. For even the construction of an argument where I'm seeking to find evidence for my beliefs, Siegel puts it, is going to be based on my judgment of how much evidence I need to find, what kind of evidence I need to find, and when I should take things as evidence. So the picture is so much more complicated than Siegel's straightforward account seems to suggest, despite the kind of psychological compellingness of the way that he talks about critical thinking. So I want to end by offering an example from my own teaching experience. Before I started my post at Warwick University, I was the philosopher in residence at Rugby School for 7 years. And in that role, I was asked to sort of go in across different curriculum subjects and introduce and infuse a sort of philosophical dimension to thought in the different subjects. So I worked with colleagues in maths and English, science, modern languages, to kind of open up thinking in the subject areas that are currently there, rather than tacking thinking on in a separate sort of part of the curriculum. So I've had some anecdotes at the end of my PhD about my experiences, and I thought they might be helpful to sort of illustrate the idea I'm talking about. So I'm going to just read the long quote at the end to finish. So I was invited by a colleague in the foreign languages department to join one of her lessons, in which they'd been reading the play Le Juste by Albert Camus. The play is based on the true story of a group of Russian socialist revolutionaries who plan and execute the assassination of Grand Duke. In the course of studying this text, a number of themes for discussion had emerged within the class. Knowing my background in philosophy and interest in existentialism, my colleague invited me along to stimulate further discussion of some of the themes. The brief was quite open. The teacher simply wanted her students to have the chance to re-engage with some of the interesting themes that had arisen in the course of the lessons. I decided to structure the lesson loosely around a number of themes that I had found prevalent within the text, offering a handout of 5 key quotations from the play as illustrative examples. I stated at the outset that the themes I had picked out were likely to have been largely informed by my prior knowledge of Camus as a philosopher. I therefore invited the pupils to challenge my interpretations, and they didn't need too much encouragement doing that. We read and reread the passages I'd selected, opening up and negotiating new meanings and significances. One pupil, for example, drew the class's attention to the epigraph at the outset of the play, which had interestingly not been included in my English translation. It's a quotation from Romeo and Juliet, Act 4, Scene 5. O love, O life, not life, but love and death. Does this mean that the play, which is often cast as having a political message, could be reread as a love story? And what kind of love is being invoked? We also pondered the differences between reading the text in the English translation and that I provided and the original French version the student had studied. One student felt like it seemed a different play to her when she read it in English, and this provoked discussion about whether one language can ever do justice to another, or whether there's a sense in which something is lost in translation. I don't think we got past the first 2 quotes I'd selected in the 40-minute lesson. The lesson didn't end with a sense of self-satisfied contentment, as though we'd got to the bottom of Le Juste and worked it all out. Rather, we left realising the openness and richness of the text and the possibilities of interpretation that had emerged from our engagement with just a few sections of it. And I was struck at the end of this class by just how different such a lesson had been from my usual experience of teaching existentialism within the A-level philosophy course. Here, Sartre's philosophy is introduced as a version of libertarianism, and is pitted against other views, such as free will in the free will determinism debate, such as determinism and compatibilism. Given the demands of the A-level course, I'm barely able to spend 2 40-minute lessons discussing existentialism. The result is that there's no room for thinking and responding as there was in the above-cited Camus lesson. In fact, what my students, and we should recall their philosophy students, often end up with is a sense that they know all there is to know about Sartre's philosophy, simply because they can cite his argument in nugget form and are able to roll out stock criticisms of it that often largely comprise those listed in the mark schemes for previous exam questions. Of course, this isn't necessarily my students' fault. It's a result of the exam system that's driven by quantitative assessment, by a tick-box culture that pervades over education as a whole. Rather than provide space for open and rigorous thinking of the kind I have articulated, and would contend is in operation in the above-cited example of the Camus class, the A-level philosophy lesson on Sartre rather seems to enforce a thinking that works by way of closed regurgitation. So just to very briefly finish, I'm not suggesting at all that this is some sort of gold standard that should be held up, or that it's providing a sort of worked out framework for teaching the kind of thinking that follows from my account. And it'd be too much to suggest that education should always look like this. But I do want to say that teaching and learning can be designed to keep open possibilities of this kind. And I would suggest that by doing so, we move towards a more adequate way of developing thinking that does justice to the rich possibilities of the ways we think.